This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. 50 years of history as we look back on the March on Washington in 1963 that set the stage for so much change in America. Later this hour, one of the voices in the crowd on that day with an unflinching assessment of where the fight against racism stands today. Also, we note four unusual trials with unexpected proceedings or unexpected outcomes: the sentencing of Bradley Manning, Robert Bales, the upcoming sentencing of Fort Hood shooter Nidal Hassan, and most fascinating of all, the show trial of China's Bo Xilai. We'll have a couple of tech stories. A very smart eighth grader tries to reassure middle-agers without humiliating them. He succeeds. A big data entrepreneur tries to scare us with an algorithm that could predict who is most likely to commit a felony. He succeeds. But first, the clues and bloody evidence from a crime scene in Syria. A possible chemical weapons attack has now become likely, with many in the international community saying it has been confirmed. But here's the president speaking to CNN.
What we've seen indicates that this is clearly a big event of grave concern. And you know, we are already in communications with the entire international community. We're moving through the UN to try to prompt better action from them. And we've called on the Syrian government to allow an investigation of the site because UN inspectors are on the ground right now. We don't expect cooperation given their past history.
The Syrian government has continued to deny the use of any such chemical weapons, but on Friday, Russia urged the government to cooperate with UN investigators searching for evidence of chemical warfare. It appears that U.S. forces may be considering some kind of military response. Naval vessels were reportedly moved towards Syria over the weekend. But the president's language is still a language of warnings, not action at this point.
When you start seeing chemical weapons used on a large scale, and again, we're still gathering information about this particular event, but it is very troublesome.
It remains uncertain how the U.S. and the European Union will move forward in the region. Joining us now is Lara Satrakian, journalist and founder of Syria Deeply. Lara, welcome.
Great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the issue at hand, this question of the use of chemical weapons and how it may have motivated the international community to do something coherent here in response. What are the pieces of the story on the ground in the area around Damascus that's been affected?
Well, right now you have the U.S., the U.K., France, Turkey, Israel all saying that the Assad regime is pretty unquestionably responsible for a chemical attack on the area of Eastern Ghouta outside of Damascus that killed, by Doctors Without Borders count, more than 350 people, injured thousands. And a consensus emerging in the Western world that something has to be done about this, that this purported chemical weapons attack is the trigger that would escalate this conflict to a point of external military intervention, presumably U.S.-led military intervention. At the same time, you have a counter-narrative coming out of Russia and China and, of course, the Assad regime, that the rebels are the ones who actually use the chemical weapons, that there's no definitive proof that the regime is behind this attack. All of this is premature. Russia comparing this scenario to the run-up to the Iraq war, and a clear strategic threat on the part of Syria that if the U.S. or anyone else were to intervene with missile strikes or any other moves on Syrian territory, we would see the consequences and repercussions in a, quote, fireball inflaming the Middle East at large.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Russian rhetoric here. This isn't the first time they've used the implausible WMD argument, hearkening back to what happened in Iraq. But in this particular case, we're not talking about storehouses of WMDs. We know that the Syrians have storehouses of chemical weapons. The question really is of use right now. How does that change the argument?
Absolutely. And to your point, this emerging consensus also that it was a sarin gas attack in particular. Syria is known to have stockpiles of sarin gas. The UN inspection team that is now going to on a fact-finding mission in that area was already in country because of more than a dozen cases of believed chemical weapons attacks before the headlines of last week. So there's this incontrovertible fact that Syria has chemical weapons, that there are now documented cases of the Assad regime using them on selected targets. What really changed last week was this language around it being an indiscriminate and widespread attack. The fact that what happened last week, as we understand it, is on a broader scale with broader civilian consequences than anything we had seen to date. So that was really the fundamental change.
We learned this month that there are a million children who are believed to be refugees in some manner of this conflict that's gone on for well over 2 years now. Given the scale of the conventional weapons used and the casualties already in the record books, from the perspective of people on the ground in Syria, does this attack constitute an escalation, even though the international community may regard it as a fundamental change from their perspective, what they're seeing, the brutality that happens every single day? Do they view this as an escalation?
What we hear again and again from Syrian civilians is that there is not a steep escalation. This isn't a particular change. This isn't any fundamentally different from what they experience on a day-to-day basis, which is indiscriminate rocket attacks on rebel-held areas. Now, several cases, as I mentioned, more than a dozen reported cases of chemical weapons being used on civilian and rebel areas. This feeling in Syria that this is dragging on with deadly consequence day after day, and the West only really seems to notice on particular occasions when we say that there's a particular milestone. So when you watch this war unfold in slow motion, you really see the consequences affecting people and this kind of malaise that has set in, this feeling that the world has forgotten them, even a deep skepticism to the point where now that you have Washington changing tack and considering military intervention, moving military assets, you even have a kind of cynicism in Syria that, you know what, nobody really cares. Everyone's looking out for their interests, but no one fundamentally is willing to step in and take the initiative and take leadership to stop this war from dragging on.
So after all of this time, the focus on chemical weapons here, as brutal as this attack seems to have been, it feels like a symbolic response to a symbolic single attack over a two-year war, and that a international community symbolic response, some sort of missile firing or a naval blockade, is not going to have the effect of actually changing things on the ground. Is that fair?
Absolutely. It comes off to Syrians like a symbolic and rather limited response on the part of the international community. The U.S. even saying, even if we do take on any kind of military intervention, it will be very circumspect. We don't expect boots on the ground. We're not trying to debilitate the Assad regime. At the very most, the U.S. and its allies would step in to punish this particular attack, so as to deter future use of chemical weapons. But this is not the world saying we're going to step in and stop Syria's war or prevent civilian casualties. This would be a very surgical and direct retaliation for what's seen as Syria itself violating international law with the use of chemical weapons. And this notion of red lines crossed or not crossed, that's what really begins to settle into the Syrian mind that, you know what, there's very little Assad can do that would really trigger a massive international response. That leads to a kind of loss of U.S. credibility in this conflict. 2 years after Washington calls for the Assad regime to step down, what are they really willing to do about it? At the same time, a strategic calculus that you can understand in Washington, that there are not only no good options here, but that practically all options lead to very bad outcomes.
Lara Satrakian, founder of Syria Deeply, speaking to us from London. Thanks so much, Lara.
Thank you.
Joining us now, P.J. Crowley, former Department of State spokesperson, currently a professor at George Washington University. P.J., welcome back.
Hello, John.
So no good outcomes. We've discussed that before. The question of is this under any circumstances little more than a symbolic response, whatever the international community comes up with. We haven't talked about that before in the context of a chemical weapons attack. Is the administration painted into a corner on some level, or can they really change the game on the ground in Syria?
Well, that's the calculation the White House appears to be trying to determine now. And with the rhetoric that you hear in Washington now, it would appear that a decision's been made that some kind of action will be taken. The real question is it to send a message as a deterrent to Bashar al-Assad that whatever else you want to do in this civil war or civil wars, the use of chemical weapons will not be tolerated? Or in some fashion, is the United States and others now determined to tilt the battlefield in a decisive way that favors the opposition?
Let's get to the tilt, the battlefield in a moment. Under any circumstances, if a deterrent message is all that they manage to come up with, isn't that a message to the Syrians on the ground? Everything we've seen up till now is permitted by the international community.
Well, I recognize, you know, the point that Laura made just a moment ago about, you know, the international community being focused on how 1,000 people were killed and not the other 100,000 that have died over the course of the last 2 years. And the conundrum here is that, in my view, you don't have one war going on. It's not just a war between Bashar al-Assad and an opposition. It's a war between Sunnis and Shia. It's a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's a war involving an al-Qaeda sympathetic group that now holds territory in Syria. So from a United States or international community standpoint, it's if you choose to intervene, you know, which war are you intervening within and to what effect? And most importantly, at what level of cost? And is that something that is sustainable in terms of public opinion, both in the United States and around the world?
Well, of course, P.J. Crowley, former Department of State spokesperson, you and I can play the hindsight game as long as we want here on the radio. Let's do it for a minute or so. You've described a deck really stacked against the administration in doing something that can either enter the right war or alter the battlefield. Is that an argument for an intervention that would have taken place early in the game before the opposition became so infiltrated with al-Qaeda, before the sort of Iran-Saudi Arabia dynamic began to develop, and, you know, before Russia really seems to have the upper hand now, putting the U.S. on the defensive at every turn?
Well, I think the difference, say, between Syria and what we saw in the context of Libya 2 years ago is that the United Nations has been sidelined. So you do not necessarily have the consensus within the region for a particular course of action. And understand, you know, that you know, while the United States has its own views about what should be done, ultimately, whatever the United States or the international community does has to be supported by countries like Iraq, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, because the impact is going to be felt in the neighborhood, not beyond. And the Goldilocks kind of problem that you have is that any kind of escalation, either from within Syria or outside Syria, has the potential to escalate this beyond Syria's borders. I think the administration has been reluctant to get directly involved as a military combatant. I think that caution is prudent. But now, because you have run out of effective political opposition or political options, the Geneva process that was set up to have a negotiation directly between the Assad regime and the opposition, which would lead to Assad voluntarily stepping down, that process is frozen. So I think with this latest incident involving chemical weapons, the Obama administration is now forced to really seriously consider military options for the first time.
P.J. Crowley, former Department of State spokesperson, currently a professor at George Washington University. And now a look at the U.S. military on trial for now convicted murderer Robert Bales, the staff sergeant who admitted to killing 16 Afghans, including women and children, in a horrific deliberate attack last March. It will be life without parole. And that's a controversial decision for some of his Afghan victims. Meanwhile, Army psychiatrist Major Nidal Hassan may not avoid the death penalty as a military jury considers his sentence for the killing of 13 soldiers at Fort Hood in an attack in November of 2009. Hassan told the court he was willing to die as a martyr. His sentencing phase begins today at Fort Hood. Convicted of espionage, Private Bradley Manning was also sentenced last week, 35 years at Leavenworth Army Prison. But the leaker and self-styled whistleblower who changed our view of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had one more bombshell for the world after his sentencing. He is a woman now, Chelsea. The defendant came out as a transgender, which certainly complicates his sentence of 35 years at an all-male prison. A spokeswoman for Fort Leavenworth said that the prison does not provide hormone therapy or sex reassignment surgery for gender identity disorder. And that's something Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, reacted to on the NBC Today show last week.
I'm hoping Fort Leavenworth would do the right thing and provide that. If Fort Leavenworth does not, then I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that they are forced to do so.
Joining us to explore the transgender experience in prison and generally is Alicia Williams. She's Director of Prisoner Justice at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. And the Sylvia Rivera Law Project is an advocacy group for transgender identity in all phases, not just prison, right?
Correct.
All right. So what is the right thing to do? Let's talk about Fort Leavenworth for a moment. Are they under obligation to provide this hormone therapy and other treatments for a transgender disorder? That's what the person referred to there at Fort Leavenworth.
According to the Leavenworth representative, they're saying that they are not required to, but actually, according to both medical and legal precedent, they should be required to, ensuring that all people who are incarcerated have their Eighth Amendment rights protected. That's what several state and federal courts have decided. And state and federal courts are also making sure that prisons are providing necessary medical care for people who identify as transgender.
And as far as you're concerned, he's Chelsea Manning.
Correct.
She is Chelsea Manning.
Yes.
I mean, that's a policy we discussed and made here at The Takeaway. But I'm wondering if a diagnosis is required before we say that. Is that something that he, she can say and then we go along with that? How is that sort of determined?
Well, one of the things that we push at Sylvia Rivera Law Project is gender self-determination. You don't need a legal decision, a court order, to be identified with the appropriate pronouns or name that you choose for yourself.
The idea being that nobody fakes transgender. It's a feeling that you have. It's an impulse that is unmistakable and within mm-hmm. you. And by even identifying yourself, that's a part of the whole experience.
Exactly. And there are several people in prison who are now receiving medical care and they did not identify as transgender before going inside. There are a lot of people who aren't really familiar with the terminology or don't know what's out there for them as far as medical care and things. And it's not something that they may identify with until they are in prison. And that doesn't mean that they should not be receiving the medical care that they need.
And we're down the road here a ways. I mean, there's Orange is the New Black. That's the television show which actually talks about this experience of being transgender in prison. There are cases of prisons dealing with this in prison, both in the civilian and military sector, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's not as though Chelsea Manning is something fundamentally new in American criminal justice.
Right. I think it's new to the public, to people who are not in the advocacy circle, who aren't already familiar with gender identity disorder. Sophia, Laverne Cox's character on Orange is the New Black, she's doing a great job of
– She was on the show.
Putting out some of those issues, yeah. I mean, Laverne as the actress portraying Sophia, but also as an advocate, she's doing a great job with the media opportunities she's received.
It's so interesting because we had that conversation here on the program and really thought we were way out on the edge of something. And then this happens. And, of course, you know, this is mainstream. This is right in the middle of what we're considering in the headlines and what the U.S. military is considering. What is the likelihood? Here's a selection from a 2006 documentary called Cruel and Unusual. Mm-hmm. This is Anna Connelly, transgender woman, former prisoner at the Florida Department of Corrections, describing her conditions there. What is the likelihood that neglected Chelsea Manning may have this experience as well? Listen.
A sergeant had frisked me once, and then he decided he was going to do it again in front of everybody else. He got behind me and started feeling my breasts and squeezing my nipples with his fingers and rolling them around and grabbing my butt and squeezing it and patting it and just acting like a pervert. And there's nothing you could do but just stand there and take it. They told me that I was never going to leave the prison alive.
Alicia Williams, is that backlash that that woman is describing the result of the public's lack of understanding of what's going on here or the prison system's lack of understanding?
Both. It's very common because, I mean, as far as my clients right now, I have 35 people on my case list and several on my wait list and several that I hear from on a day-to-day basis, and they're all describing the same sort of physical and sexual harassment. I had a client recently write in and tell me that as soon as she entered the prison, she's in a male facility. As soon as she entered the prison, the officers were harassing her, saying, "You'll never be a woman. You're a man in a man's prison." And they pushed her on the ground and made her do push-ups until she collapsed.
How do you assess the relevance of this revelation now, Chelsea Manning, based on all the other facts of the case? Do you think it has something to do with why Private Bradley Manning, the leaker, became this person really in confrontation with the U.S. Army? Is it an experience that has any relevance to the circumstances of the trial, or is it just some other detail?
I think it's a totally separate detail. It seems that Chelsea was identifying as a woman or having some of those feelings well before any of these leaks or anything occurred. And whether or not the trial had happened, I still think that she probably would have eventually come out as transgender as Chelsea Manning.
How worried are you about Chelsea at this point?
Very worried. Just in the context of prisons themselves, they are the primary source for state violence that trans people and low-income people face every day. And especially being in this hyper-masculine environment of the military, I fear for her safety even more.
Alicia Williams is Director of Prisoner Justice at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, an advocacy group for transgender. Alicia Williams, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Perhaps the most fascinating trial of them all came to a conclusion today in China. Fallen Communist Party politician Bo Xilai facing charges of bribery and embezzlement, abuse of power in his attempt to conceal the poisoning of British businessman Neil Hayward. It will take weeks for a verdict and sentence, but the trial itself has already rocked the new Chinese establishment. Jonathan Fenby has been closely watching this trial. He's China director of the research company Trusted Sources. His latest book on China is Tiger Head, Snake Tails, China Today. Jonathan, welcome.
Glad to be here.
What did this trial showcase for the people of China and for the rest of the world regarding his particular situation and just the state of the judiciary and politics in China?
I think there were two main takeaways, if I can use that word, from this trial. The first was, although Bo Xilai himself denied any corruption, taking any bribes directly, still the evidence, which pertained mainly to his wife and his son and to various other people, showed just how much money is sloshing around in China. You know, bundles of cash being taken out of secret safes, a $3 million villa in the south of France, all expenses paid by a businessman, trips to Africa, to Venice, to the World Cup in Germany, and so on. So that was one thing. But the other thing which was really interesting fundamentally in this was the nature of the trial, the fact that Bo Xilai was allowed to speak out in his own defense, to cross-examine prosecution witnesses, to describe his wife, who was a main prosecution witness, as mentally unstable, to have a confrontation with the former police chief, who was much involved in his affairs over all this period. So there was a relative degree of greater transparency in this than we've seen really in any Chinese trial that I can remember. And there were regular blogs, official blogs from the court to tell the outside world what was going on, which highlighted those various elements I've just talked about. So this was a highly unusual trial.
Was Bo Xilai himself making the argument that corruption exists everywhere in the Chinese government? Was there a larger political statement he was making, either about reform or the direction of the government that might have done him in because he was at odds with the power elite?
Well, not really, it must be said, because while I say this was a very unusual trial in China, at the same time, it was pretty contained. It was pretty circumscribed. The most of the evidence dated back to the 1990s when Bo was mayor of a big city in northeast China, and then it was focused on the death, allegedly, at the hands of Bo's wife, of the British businessman Neil Hayward in Chongqing, this mega city which Bo ran until his downfall last year. There was no broader discussion of bribery, corruption, or any mention of other senior officials with whom Bo was quite closely associated during his rise to power.
Is this a show? Do we think he's cooperated with the government in any sense, that that will be reflected when there's a verdict later this year?
If the final prosecution summing up is anything to go by, he'll get a heavy sentence, probably a long prison sentence or possibly a suspended death sentence. But I think there were, 17 months of negotiations between him being pulled in and the trial taking place. And I think during that period, almost certainly he and the authorities, the new leadership in China, worked out the ground rules. And within those ground rules, as I say, he was able would have quite a lot of freedom, but he didn't stray outside them into broader questions of, you know, how corrupt the leadership is in China. And for the new leadership headed by Xi Jinping, the party chief and state president, they can kind of say now to Bo's supporters, well, look, we let him speak out, and so please now accept whatever verdict is passed on him. So there was a lot of horse trading in this along the way.
Jonathan Fenby, China director of the research company Trusted Sources, author of the book Tiger Head, Snake Tales, China Today. Thanks so much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In a moment, the power of technology to make plausible and, you might conclude, pretty terrifying predictions about people is data destiny. But first, it seems that the destiny of young Quinn Ettnayer is to be an evangelist for technological understanding. He's created a niche for himself as the comforting tech coach for intimidated middle-agers who have been stymied by their own fear of coding and electronic circuits. He started his own teaching company called QTechno, K-N-O-W, which sells electronic kits for people who feel they've been left behind in the tech parade. Quinn, who will soon be entering eighth grade, that's right, is already an inventor. This whiz kid, math and sales genius, started right off with us with a pep talk.
Anyone can learn, and I think, like, if you relate it to what you know, or, like, if you relate maybe a jumper wire in an embedded electronic circuit, say, that could be maybe a hallway, it would connect two things together, and you could just do something like that, where you relate it to something that someone else knows, and that way everyone can learn very fast.
So what is your greatest success bringing a, let's not say elderly, but let's just say a more advanced in age person to being sophisticated with digital skills that they never thought in a million years they'd be able to develop?
The Crashbase class, the first class that I taught, it was in L.A. last August. And there was the kids learned really fast. And then the parents started to be like, oh, I think I can get that. And so a few of the parents actually started to learn along with the kids, and they've been programming ever since.
Who's your oldest student? And tell me what they learned.
I think he was about maybe 50, and he even brought his friends, and it was really cool.
And you were just thrilled to see the look of joy on that 50-year-old's face when he was actually able to do something that he couldn't manage maybe with his cell phone before he met you.
Yeah, I mean, they're all really excited to see that first LED blink, you know? And so no matter what the age, everybody's really happy when they get that first thing to work.
Is there any old person who you just wrote off and said they're not going to learn? There's just no way they can learn.
No, not really. My grandma, I teach her how to use her iPhone all the time. So, yeah.
Can anyone invent? And how big is your list of inventions?
I think everyone can really invent. And so once they start to learn the basics, and they can build on that. And cool thing about the embedded electronics world is that everything's open source. So that means you can get everything online, and lots of people are really helpful. There are forums where you could get help on a certain project, and you'll always know that someone in the world will know what you're doing, and so they can always help you. So anyone really can make an invention with the help of the community, I think.
So, Quinn, last question. One of our listeners wants to know how she could Bluetooth her entire house so that everything interacts using the Bluetooth platform.
Oh, yeah. I think that would take a little bit of time because each one you would need to program individually. But I think that would be a great project because everyone would like to automate their home at some point, because if you just press one button, the lights turn on and the kitchen starts working, like the water comes to the kitchen, and then the dishwasher turns on, and then the coffee maker turns on when you get closer to your house so you can have fresh coffee once you get into your house. And so at some point, I think everyone's house will be automated. And so the first ones to get automated are the people that start being adventurous and learn all the Bluetooth and embedded electronics stuff.
And that's kind of like your house. You walk near the refrigerator and it hands you like a glass of milk, something like that.
I'm working right now on a RFID door lock. So if I just have a tag on my neck or a little bracelet, you can show it to the RFID reader, just put it in close range, and then the door will unlock, and then you can just push it open and bring groceries in and stuff like that. So that's the first home automation thing I'm doing.
Not bad, Quinn. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Eighth grader Quinn Ettnayer is founder of QTechno, a technology education company that sells electronic starter kits. He teaches technology classes to people of all ages. Here's an experiment. Follow the stories of criminals in your community. All the people who get arrested and convicted of a felony. Find out everything you can about each and every one of them. Where they live, income, education, everything. Add information like phone contacts, what video games they played, websites they visited, where they traveled, favorite TV shows, who they called. Does that get you any closer to a credible profile of who is likely to commit a felony? Now multiply all this by tens of millions. You're not just looking at people in a single community. You have a giant data set of all convicted felons. And with the right algorithm, now you can assign probability numbers to every combination of features common to groups of convicted felons. Now look at the set of everyone. Ages, education, living parents, video games. You can suddenly assign a probability to any person on earth that they will commit a felony. Would an employer be interested in such a tool? The police? How about a college? Jim Adler is an entrepreneur in the big data business who recently created a tool just like this. Kind of scared him. Lest you immediately fear mass arrests from such electronic wizardry, prior government knowledge of, say, Boston bomber Tamerlane Tsarnaev's travel experiences, family contacts, the websites he created and visited, didn't result in any predictions that he would carry out a bombing at the Boston Marathon. Jim Adler says, however flawed such algorithms are in the world of big data and NSA-scale surveillance, they still are irresistible and relatively easy to make.
Some of this is trial and error. So we took whether someone had a misdemeanor or several misdemeanors, whether they were male or female, whether they had tattoos or not. This is data that's publicly available on their criminal record. And we just start postulating whether there's correlations between those features and the fact that whether they had a felony or not. The output of the algorithm is a set of weights along these features. So the algorithm may see that females are disproportionately correlated with having a felony than males. And so when they see that someone's female, the algorithm will weight that feature higher than, say, another feature that doesn't seem to be as highly correlated with someone having a felony or not.
So let's talk about the transition from your small data set to what is possible with an algorithm like this in terms of making plausible sounding predictions of whether people commit felonies.
I mean, false positives are really the important part of this. I mean, there is this, what I've often called this anarchy-tyranny trade-off, where if you're going to be very tyrannical, you don't care about the false positives. Sweep everybody in because you'll get the felons as well. On the other side is anarchy. You basically miss all the felons and you don't catch anybody. The classifier is very insensitive. And so there is this trade-off. When you go to the airport and go through security, everybody is assumed guilty. The false positives are 99.999%, and we are okay with that. In other applications, like stop and frisk, false positives are alarmingly high. And for that application, maybe the false positives are too high to justify the benefits.
Let's get down to brass tacks here. How confident are you that you could develop in a short period of time, or maybe you already have, an algorithm that you could hand to someone like the NSA and they would be able to come up with very plausible, reasonable to defend kinds of probabilities, suspicions that X, Y, and Z are capable of behaviors D, E, and F?
I think that there's certain applications where that's quite possible. And it may not be the Ed Snowden situation. I mean, this project first occurred to me last summer after the Aurora shootings. And it, like everyone, I was wondering if there was a way to predict whether someone is capable and practically planning a horrific event like this. And I quickly came to the realization, like most of us would, that there's just not enough signal there to plausibly and reasonably filter somebody out as plausible perpetrator of an event like this. There's other activities that are quite reasonable. I mean, the felon classifier, if someone has a felon on that looks like someone that is high probability of having a felony on their record that they may not be disclosing, that may be a high enough probability that it may warrant greater investigation. So it would be a tip to say, look into this guy a little bit more closely.
If you could develop an algorithm that put together things like that, animal cruelty, propensity to commit violence, gun ownership, those sorts of things, languages you speak, could you develop an algorithm that would put Adam Lanza from Newtown on a list, or Mr. Al-Awlaki, American citizen from Yemen, on a list without having a stadium full of other people also on the list?
I don't really know. And I think that's important. That's an important point. I think if the statistics bear that out, if they're, the correlations are high enough that a causal relationship could be uncovered based on those correlations. I mean, correlations are really just hints. Correlation does not imply causation. So you can't just say, hey, things are correlated, therefore this A caused B just because A and B are correlated. But it does cause you to pay attention to the potential of this event happening and will cause you to look into it a little more deeply.
Kind of scary what you can do with big data, huh?
Well, I think technology is always a little scary at the outset. And I think that it takes a group of people from multiple disciplines, humanitarians and policy makers and ethicists, to really figure out the appropriate use for the technology. It's not necessarily good or evil. It can be used effectively if there's enough transparency to have the debate. It's scary because it's powerful. And how is the best way that it could be used?
Jim Adler is an entrepreneur and thought leader on big data, privacy, security, and voting systems.
I'm just a face in the crowd. You probably don't know me as I don't stand out.
And now all this week faces in a very historic crowd from 50 years ago.
The Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination.
The voice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 50 years ago this week at the March on Washington. As we look back, we want to note the faces in that famous crowd of 250,000. They were people who came from everywhere in the United States on that day, and who far more than Dr. King's dream speech symbolized how the nation was ready for radical change. Some of that change happened, and some of it we're still waiting for. With our partners, the New York Times, we'll bring you two of those faces in the crowd. The Times solicited its readers to submit stories of that day from people who were there. We have two of them for you this week. Joyce Ladner says she grew up fighting for her freedom and to survive the racism she saw in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. She became a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who helped organize the March on Washington. We want to warn you, Joyce did not hold back in our conversation. She said in a lifetime of activism, she fought in part against the N-word itself. And as you'll hear, she doesn't feel the need to use that tame euphemism. For Joyce, the march was her first big success as an activist, driven by having seen America's worst as a little girl.
You know, I grew up under the shadow of lynchings. I was 11 years old when Emmett Till was killed, and I know that I vowed, and many of my friends vowed, that when we got old enough, we would do something to avenge his death. By the time I went away to college, I helped to organize a student civil rights protest and was expelled and transferred to Tougaloo College the following year. Tougaloo, by the way, is called the Civil Rights College because it was the only place in Mississippi where black people and white people could gather. It was the only place where we called it our oasis in the desert. It was at Tougaloo that I met Martin Luther King in 1962. I went to jail and spent almost a week in jail while I was a student at Tougaloo.
So with all that pushback, with the jail, the expulsions, how did you believe that you were making progress, that you were making a difference?
We knew that in the end, I suppose we may have been very young in thinking this, but we felt that right would prevail. We also knew that increasingly Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, those states were being isolated because of their practices. I have to say that I failed the voter registration test 3 times when I was in college. I couldn't pass the literacy test. And of course I knew that was wrong. I mean, you had to keep pushing back, but we found refuge and strength, I should say, in each other because we all believed in exactly the same thing. One day, change would come.
So then at the march 50 years ago, what did you see in the faces that told you that this was a national movement, that this could tip the scales?
I saw optimism. I saw hope. I saw a yearning on the part of our supporters, you know, to really, really be of help. You know, I had spent that summer going around crisscrossing Manhattan and the metropolitan area of New York to raise money to bring black people from the South to the march. Every time I went out to speak, I came back with enough money to charter another bus. I remember one time I got a check from a woman who lived on Park Avenue, and she sent a $500 check. You know, that was a lot of money back then. And she said that she was a Southerner, that she couldn't go to the march, but she surely wanted to help other people come from the South. And that was, you know, it gave me goose pimples up. All of my 19-year-old optimism just came forth, you know.
I can see it. And the 19-year-old holding that check with goosebumps imagining what could happen when the march actually took place. It was about more than what we remember or the media remembers as just Dr. King's moment, right?
Oh, by far. And I think it's unfair to Dr. King for his legacy to be reduced to I have a dream, as it's been done, because he was much, much more than that. Dr. King gave a great speech. People rose to their feet. But I didn't walk away listening to anyone who said the march was the speech. You know, you had Roy Wilkins on the stage for the NAACP. John Lewis spoke. Whitney Young, head of the Urban League, spoke. And, of course, the venerable A. Philip Randolph, who conceptualized the march in the first place and had wanted to march back in the 1940s and was founder of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He spoke. So you had some heavy hitters on the stage.
Definitely. And, you know, it's funny, if we think about today as being different from then, and there's so many differences and there's so many issues that were important then that are still important, even more urgent today. But I'm wondering if, you know, the march was held today and the same people spoke today, wouldn't we be spending a lot of time talking about how there were no women up on the podium, there were no gays up on the podium, it wasn't diverse, maybe no Asians spoke? It's a different way we have of evaluating events like that, don't you think?
There's a very different way of evaluating events. My friends and I have been wondering which rap artists would show. What bothers me so much today is that we have people like Jay-Z and Lil Wayne and some of these, you know, other artists who have no consciousness whatsoever about this recent history and what went on, and especially of the struggles that people went through. I mean, people were lynched. 3 civil rights workers who were lynched and murdered in Mississippi. 2 of them were my friends. I knew them. We fought against being called a nigger. And these young people feel that they want to use it in their art. There is no way that I could ever feel positive about that, because I was called nigger growing up many times and threatened. And so my memory runs very, very strong and deep. And I think that the other thing that bothers me is that so many people who laid the foundation for the success of a lot of young people today, they don't understand, or don't appreciate, rather, the shoulders on which they stand. I sometimes wonder if my generation dropped the ball by not very conscientiously and consciously teaching the next generation what the real lessons were to be learned from the civil rights struggle. And I think that the disconnect that bothers me most is that of a very self-indulgent individualism, of people who say, I got mine, you get yours the best way you can, and who don't feel they have to give anything back.
Well, Joyce, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that as a young person, when you heard about what happened to Emmett Till, that you and many of your friends vowed that you would live your life to avenge that death and what happened to him. You've described a sense of dropping the ball, a sense of frustration, a sense of maybe having not accomplished all that you wanted. Do you feel as though Emmett Till would be happy with the work you've done?
Oh, I would think so. I would hope so. My great uncle, who was in World War One, talked about a terrible experience that he had when he was in France and when he was discriminated against and when some French people asked him if they could see his tail as in a monkey tail. And he was very, very bitter about that. But he was also bitter because he had gone abroad to fight for justice and democracy. And he, like my father and others in World War II, you know, were denied democracy in their own land. So my uncle used to sit us on the back porch with him. And as he listened to Jackie Robinson play baseball, he would say, "You girls are going to have to be the Jackie Robinson of your day." And I guess that would take with some kids and others it may not, but it sure took with me.
Joyce Ladner, Field Secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at the March on Washington. Joyce, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
What dream do you have for the United States for the next 50 years?
My American dream is simple. Treat each other the way that we want to be treated.
Thanks to Jane there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your dream. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.